And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscowane. The long-awaited Summer Olympics are here, with opening ceremonies getting underway in a matter of hours now. The 2012 Olympics also mark 100 years since a young super athlete from Pennsylvania won gold medals for the pentathlon and decathlon in the Stockholm Olympics. As he received his medals, Jim Thorpe was pronounced the greatest athlete in the world by the King of Sweden. That glory didn't last long. Thorpe was stripped of his medals a year later when it was discovered that he had played semi-professional baseball. Still, there are many who would argue that Jim Thorpe remains the greatest, or at least one of the greatest, athletes of all time. We'll preview the 2012 games a little bit later, but we begin with the 1912 games and a retrospective on the life and legacy of Jim Thorpe. To do that, we have enlisted the help of historian Bill Mallon. He is co-founder and past president of the International Society of Olympic Historians, and he's written 24 books on the subject. He also happens to be an orthopedic surgeon and a former professional golfer, and he joins us from London. Bill, welcome to Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Kate Buford, author of Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. Kate is also a contributor to NPR's Morning Edition and American Public Media's Marketplace. Kate, welcome to Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Kate, tell us, what got you interested in the life of Jim Thorpe to begin with?
Well, my previous biography was of Burt Lancaster, the Hollywood star and producer, and as most of you probably know or have seen on television often, he played Jim Thorpe in Jim Thorpe, All-American, a Warner Brothers biopic in 1951. So in doing the work in the production file in Hollywood in the Warner Brothers collection at USC, I was so struck by this story, which I was not familiar with. And I was also struck with, and this is 1950 when the movie's being made, with this flood of postcards and letters that came in to Jack Warner, the head of the studio, from fans all over the country saying, don't mess with the story of our hero. And he hadn't played any official game since about 1928. And so I wondered, as any, I think, good biographer does, or curious biographer, why that heat? Why that passion? Why did people care so much? And so when it came time to write my next book, I didn't want to repeat myself in the movies and thought, sports are the common passion of our time. Why? Where did it start? And that brings us back to Jim Thorpe.
Interesting personality, Kate, is my impression. It sounds like, despite the fact that he really was a super athlete, that he sounded like a fairly simple guy in terms of his personality.
He was. He was a very straightforward guy. Intelligent, simple, straightforward, reserved. As I said in the book, he was not a complicated person, but what happened to him was very complicated.
And how so?
He was at the dawn of organized sports in this country, and that was what fascinated me, was the history of all of these various sports, including the modern Olympic movement. So he's right on the ground floor or field, if you will, of the beginning of the modern Olympic movement, and particularly football. Baseball was pretty well established. So he gets caught up in a swirl of events that are going on, forming these sports, the domination particularly of the Olympics by a very elitist group. He's an outsider as a Native American, as almost anyone was then who was not a WASP. So many people identified with him, and that was also a very compelling reason why he was remembered so vividly.
Bill Mallon, tell us how Jim Thorpe was discovered. I mean, who figured out that this, you know, Native American boy in a school for Native Americans was such a great athlete?
Well, he was at Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania, and he just went over to the track practice one day and just was fooling around, jumped over the high jump bar, and the coach of the track team was a guy named Pop Warner, who was also the coach of the football team, a legendary football coach, and he just broken the school record for the high jump on his first try, and he realized, like, you know, you ought to come out for track, and Thorpe at first, you know, just said, this is just what I do. It was nothing unusual to him.
All in a day's work. And wasn't he in overalls or something when he did this?
Yes, he was in overalls and what was called then a hickory shirt.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so broke the school's world record on that first try. Bill, his background, I mean, certainly he wasn't preparing for an athletic career, and certainly not in the way that young people do today, but it was just, you know, good old-fashioned labor, it sounds like, that prepared him for this.
Yeah, I mean, there are erroneous reports that Kay can probably verify that, you know, he was lazy and didn't train very hard. But, you know, he had a lot of talent, but he trained very hard, too. There was a guy on the U.S. team in 1912 who went over on the boat with him named Abel Kvyat, who was a miler or 1,500-meter runner. And Kvyat said, it's false that Thorpe just sat around and did no training. He trained as hard as anyone did then. Now, training in that era was a lot different than it is now. They didn't train 6 or 7 hours a day like all the athletes do now, but Thorpe trained as hard as anyone.
Well, Kate, you wonder what he might have done had he, been around in this day and age when you see, you know, children in all the sports camps and, you know, the travel squads and the elite squads and how sports has become almost a job for young children. But there's high-level training. There's a lot of, you know, private coaching going on.
Mm-hmm.
Very different scenario for Jim Thorpe.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and so is Bill's, and I totally agree with him, that even at the time, though, athletes like Kvyat looked at Thorpe and thought, wow, what could he do if he even got the better training that was available at the time? One of the best-known trainers of the time was Mike Murphy, and he was on board ship, and the Americans were criticized, actually, in 1912, 100 years ago, for training too hard because they had already begun more systematic training than, say, the British. So people wondered, what would Thorpe have done, even doing so well at the Olympics, if he had had even the kind of training that was available then? By the same token, Thorpe always felt badly that the trend to specialize, which you already see in 1912, and Bill can corroborate, only becomes more pronounced as the century goes forward. And Jim used to always say, gosh, it's too bad that today's young athletes can't just do everything like I did.
Hmm. And Bill, tell us something about that. Back in 1912, Stockholm Olympics, how did athletes prepare for that, and how was it different, and I'm sure in many ways, from the kinds of Olympics that we think of today?
You can't believe in...
Billy,
okay. $15 billion, and the games back then cost a few hundred thousand dollars to put on. The security here, there was none in 1912. In terms of preparing for the games, it was much more of a hobby, an amateur type approach to it. They didn't, you know, almost all the athletes now, whether they actually get paid or make any money, are professionals in their approach to it and the way they do it. In that era, this was just kind of a thing they did while they did other things in their life, school or jobs. And, you know, there were amateur restrictions and people had to follow them, so there were limits on what they could do.
And that made Jim Thorpe stand out all the more, it seems, because when you look at pictures of him from that time, he's pretty muscular, particularly relative to other athletes of that time, at least from the pictures we have.
Yeah, what I say is if you look at, the bodybuilders today, the term they use is their cut.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at old-time athletes, they're not, but Jim Thorpe was. He really looked like a sort of a modern athlete with his lean lines and everything.
Yeah. So, Kate, how did he make it from this school that he attended to the Olympics?
Well, there you have to look at Pop Warner as the central figure here in so many ways, good and bad. As Bill said, he was the coach of both football and track and field. In fact, he was the athletic director at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School. He governed everything having to do with sports. Jim arrived at Carlisle in 1904, was sent out on the outing program, came back in 1907, and begins to really hit his stride from 1907 on. In 1909, he left the school never intending to return. He wanted to break into professional baseball. And he didn't do that well in the minor leagues. It was not a semi-professional team. It was a professional team in the minor leagues that he played on, two of them, in 1909 and 1910. But he didn't do well enough to break into the majors. So Pop Warner lures him back to Carlisle in the fall of 1911. Jim's taller, he's bigger, he's older, he's in his mid-20s by this point. He begins to set his reputation as a great football player, but he'd also showed enormous promise in the 1909 track season at Carlisle before he left. So Warner brings him back saying, I want you to play for the football team, but also Warner was very much in mind of the 2012 Olympics coming up. So Warner is the key person who's driving Thorpe at this point.
So, Bill, what was his performance like? He takes off for Stockholm and amazes people pretty much. Tell us about his performance.
Well, he finished. He won the decathlon. He won the pentathlon. In the decathlon, he won 7 of the 10 events. In the pentathlon, he won 3 of the 5, and that's unheard of anymore. He won by an enormous margin. I can't even remember. It's around 700 points in the decathlon. The record that he set was actually not broken until around 1928 or 1929, although at that time it was disallowed after he was declared a professional. He also, it's not as well known, but Kate would know, he also competed in two individual events in Stockholm, in the high jump and the long jump. He finished fourth in the high jump and seventh in the long jump. That's pretty rare. That was done a little bit by decathletes through the 1950s. They would occasionally compete, but to compete in two other ones and finish that high up, basically be a finalist in two others, is pretty amazing. He also was the either the second or the third best American in the high hurdles in 1912, which he did not compete in at the Olympics.
And Bill, that makes it all the more tragic, I would think, that he ended up losing his medals after that, given the performance that he put on that just sort of blew everyone away. Really underscores the tragedy of losing all that.
Yeah, well, he was railroaded on the medals in a lot of different ways. It was known that he had played minor league baseball before 1912. That wasn't something that people just discovered. I mean, I found articles in the 1909 Rocky Mountain newspapers that talked about, you know, Jim Thorpe, the great guy from Carlisle, is competing for the Rocky Mountain Railroaders this year. And when it was brought up in a newspaper article published up in Massachusetts in early 1913, James Sullivan, who was the director of the AAU and kind of the U.S. Olympic Committee at that time, sort of went after Thorpe on amateur statutes. You have to know something about Sullivan to understand that. Sullivan was not a nice guy, and he wanted to be a way he could show, you know, how tough he was and maybe get on the International Olympic Committee and really get involved with it more. But Thorpe, as Kate said, was kind of a naive, you know, young Native American boy, and, you know, he wrote a very poignant letter in which he said, you know, I am not wise in the ways of the world, and he didn't know what he was doing.
Mm. Kate, I'm sorry, go ahead, Bill.
But it didn't matter. They took the medals from him anyway.
Yeah. Kate, we've got about 30 seconds till the break, but whatever you can add to that to tell us about how things played out for him that following year.
Well, it's complicated. We may want to pick it up after the break, but Thorpe, in fact, Warner wrote that letter along with Friedman, and Thorpe had signed an entry form attesting that he had never been paid for playing sports. He was guided by Warner, but it's a much more complicated situation, I think, and goes against this huge avalanche of amateur fervor that was exactly that Bill puts his finger on with Sullivan. So it gets, there's more nuances, and maybe we could get into that after
absolutely.
The break.
Well, we will pick that up after the break. We are talking about not only the 2012 Olympics, but the 1912 Olympics and what happened to Jim Thorpe. Of course, later on, we will have a preview of the 2012 games as well. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, BigBlueMarbleBooks.com.
Although you can use it to scrub pots and pans, few gardeners sing the praises of the weed known as horsetail. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at this ancient and unusual plant. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Olympic competition is already underway in London, but beyond the Olympic flame, some off-field controversies are already burning. We'll check in with the Barbershop Guys about some racial drama preceding the games. Oh, and yeah, we'll talk about the games, from trampoline to track. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
WHYY, through American Graduate, is now offering scholarships to teachers of grades 7 through 12 for visual storytelling basics for the classroom at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Apply for your scholarship at whyy.org/American Graduate.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the Olympics, and not just the 2012, but the 1912. It's 100 years since Jim Thorpe amazed the world with his athletic prowess, and then shortly thereafter was stripped of all of those medals. We're talking about his life and legacy, and we're also going to have a preview of the 2012 Games, who we should be watching for and what interesting stories are coming out of London. But we've been talking with Bill Mallon, who is co-founder and past president of the International Society of Olympic Historians. He also has written a series of books about the early Olympic Games, including the 1912 Games in Stockholm that we're talking about today. And Bill, you're joining us from London. We can hear a little bit of activity around you.
I'm in the main press center here.
So no wonder, so much activity. How are things going so far?
They seem to be going pretty well. I actually only got here about an hour ago. I had a horrific flight getting out with spending 6 hours on the tarmac at Washington Dulles. But
oh my! But you're in the thick of things now, it sounds like.
Yes.
Wow. And we also have with us Kate Buford, who is the author of 2010's Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. She also wrote 2000's Burt Lancaster, A Life. And our listeners may recognize Kate's name from her contributions to NPR's Morning Edition and from American Public Media's Marketplace. So, Kate, welcome back. When we left off, you were in the middle of making a point. We were talking about the complexities of what happened to Jim Thorpe following his Olympic gold at the time that the medals were stripped a year later. And I'd like you to pick up where you left off, if you would.
Yeah. Again, the role of Pop Warner in what happens in January 1913 when the newspaper scoop reveals that the great Jim Thorpe had played professionally in North Carolina in minor league baseball. What happens is an interesting scramble where Thorpe and Sullivan, James Sullivan, who Bill has mentioned, the head of the AAU, previous head of the AAU, are both trying to save their reputations, and they hang Jim Thorpe out to dry. Mm-hmm. And what happens, in effect, is that Jim had no advocate to argue for him. He had played for pay. He had signed an entry form for the Olympics saying that he had never taken any money for sports. So, strictly speaking, he did violate the amateur code that was stipulated by the IOC in 1912. And we have to go back to that time where the amateur was a term of praise, and professional was virtually a dirty word. Mm. And to take any kind of money for playing games, if you were a strict amateur, was forbidden. But it's important to remember that Jim Thorpe left Carlisle never intending to go back in 1909. He wanted to break into Major League Baseball. So he was guided, on the other hand, very much by Pop Warner. And I also speculate, and Bill could chime in here, I think if he had been an Ivy League athlete, for example, for Yale or Harvard, he would have played under an assumed name in order to guard his amateur status. There are many different nuances that play into this. But when the news breaks, the Americans, and most especially Sullivan, were so embarrassed that their greatest athlete in the world had been caught as a professional. Mm. So indeed, they railroaded with no courts of arbitration, no recourse whatsoever. In less than a week, in January 1913, Jim is stripped of his medals and the challenge trophies. They're shipped back to Stockholm. Mm.
Bill Mallon, what do you have to say about that? Was Jim Thorpe held to a different standard at the time?
Yeah, I think so. As Kate said, a lot of the athletes played minor league baseball and did other things professionally, and they played under assumed names. And Jim didn't know. He just left Carlisle in 1909 and just said, I'll just go play baseball. I just want to make some money and do what I like to do. And he didn't realize that you can play under an assumed name and get away with it, and people weren't getting caught. And as Kate said, if he'd been an Ivy League athlete or someone who'd been better coached and Pop Warner taken care of from that probably would have happened.
Yeah, and as Kate pointed out, I mean, it was certainly being done. He wasn't the first who had gotten some money to play a sport going into the Olympics, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, he came under pressure when this whole news broke. He came under pressure from Sullivan to name other college athletes that he'd played with in North Carolina, and to his credit, and his popularity went sky high. He said, "I won't do that."
Wow.
He wouldn't rat on them.
Bill, was there a national outcry then when he was stripped of the medals? Certainly, there was a lot of embarrassment and all of that. But just from sports fans, from people who had seen or heard about his achievements, was there an outcry in support of him at that time?
There was. It went round and round, just like you. In a different media world, of course, in various letters to the editor, some people said, look, just let him keep the medals. And, other people, believed in Simon pure amateurism, so they kind of went against him and said, no, you can't do that, thing. So it was back and forth.
Why has the IOC, Bill, been so resistant to reinstate him? I know there was some sort of ceremony years ago with some replica medals, but why has the IOC just really kind of put its foot down as it relates to Jim Thorpe for these many years?
Well, they did reinstate him back in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Took 70 years. There was another guy that Kate will know about named Avery Brundage, who was IOC 1972. Avery Brundage competed in the decathlon and the pentathlon in 1912 against Thorpe, and he believed in absolute strict Simon pure amateurism. So it all both 50s and 60s to the IOC to restore Thorpe's status. Avery Brundage, who was in a huge position of power with the IOC even before he was president, resisted that because he believed in Simon pure amateurism, and some people thought it was jealousy because he competed in the same events as Thorpe, and Thorpe was, head and shoulders better than he was.
Hmm. And Kate, was he, I know that there were some medals in 1982, as Bill pointed out, given to his family, but was he ever fully restored and reinstated?
No, and in fact, I'd backtrack a little bit and say that I would suggest there was quite a strong international reaction against the IOC's decision, and it fueled this hunger for vindication that in turn fuels Bill's, what he mentioned was this reinstatement movement that just wouldn't quit. People wanted to see this hero that I noticed the letters coming into Warner Brothers in 1950. It just wouldn't die, this issue, that this guy had been robbed of his due. So fast forward to 1982, after a terrific campaign by Bob Wheeler and Flo Ridlon and the Thorpe family. First, his amateur status is reinstated by the AAU, and then in the fall of 82, the IOC met and decided to reinstate Thorpe as a contender in the 1912 Olympics. But the records, they specifically excluded reinstating his records in those 15 events.
Wow.
And he had to share now the gold medal status with the original silver medal winners, who, of course, were elevated when his records were annulled.
Mm.
So you have this anomaly, what Sports Illustrated called in 83 or 82, in the worst tradition of asterisk record-keeping, that he has to share the gold medal status, which is an absurdity. I mean, as Bill said, he won by such a huge margin. And those are the only official records that exist that show us what a great athlete he was.
But
go ahead, Bill.
On the other hand, I worked as a consultant for the IOC, compiling their database of Olympic medalists, and since I believe fully in Thorpe, if you look at it, I've got Thorpe listed as first and Wieslander as second, although they both get a gold medal. Wieslander was Hugo Wieslander, the Swedish guy in the decathlon, who originally finished second, was given the gold medal after Thorpe was disqualified. But I don't know if they've changed them, I don't look at it, but I supplied all the data for them about 10 years ago, had Thorpe first, Wieslander second, but both with gold medals, as the IOC declared it to be.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about his professional career then. Kate, when after all of this happened with the Olympics, he did go on and play sports for a while.
Well, yeah, he had actually a fascinating life after 1913, which had not been chronicled really all that in detail, and he goes professional for real right after this expose in 1913 and signs with the New York Giants baseball team, which was sort of the equivalent of the Yankees of today, biggest, baddest New York team. And he flounders for a while, but eventually masters baseball and ending up by 1919 hitting as well as Ty Cobb and Joe Jackson. He also switches to professional football, which was barely a dot on the map in Stark County, Ohio in 1915, and coaches and plays for the Canton Bulldogs, which is why the Professional Football Hall of Fame is in Canton, by the way, and is the first president of the league that is formed in 1920 that will change its name in 2 years to the National Football League. So he continues to play into the late 1920s, alternating football with baseball. He even adds basketball in 1927. He goes to Hollywood in 1930 and has a whole second career as an extra and bit player in at least 70 movies in Hollywood from 1930 to 1945.
70 movies.
At least, yeah.
And you said bit parts. I mean, did he ever have any major speaking roles, or was it primarily sort of being an extra, or what did he do?
Yeah, primarily an extra in the huge resurgence of popularity with the advent of sound films in the late 20s, the multi-part serial westerns, the serial westerns that kids would go to on Saturday afternoons. The peak of his Hollywood career, if you can say that, was the movie She with Helen Gahagan Douglas, and he actually had a speaking part and a credited part in that. But otherwise, he was one of the legions of extras and bit players in Hollywood during the Depression.
The one I remember, the best prison scene in which he all the prisoners were passing some statement down the line, and he passed it on to Jimmy Cagney.
Yeah, that was White Heat. Yep. The message was his mother had died, and of course then he goes into this freak fit, you know. But yeah, Jim's one of the prisoners in the line. You're right, Bill.
Oh, interesting. Bill, how did he do as far as finances? You know, we know he went into professional sports. He went to Hollywood, and certainly those kinds of things would allow us to think that he may have made a lot of money. Do you know if he did, or what was his financial situation like?
He did okay for a few years. Baseball players and football players didn't make a fortune back then, and Thorpe didn't, and he was not, again, wise in the ways of the world and didn't manage his money very well. Kate probably knows more about this actually later in his life because she's addressed this more than I have. You know, a lot of the rumors say he was destitute. He was living in a trailer park near the end of his life, and he did have some problems with alcohol use. But then other sources say he wasn't quite as poor as people made it out to be, so I'll let Kate handle that part.
Kate, what do you say?
Yeah, I'd agree basically with Bill. I'll embellish a little bit. He made good money playing in the major leagues and the high minors into the 20s, also supplemented again by football in the fall. So he was playing two sports, and he did quite well financially, but what's really important, up to a point, and then he doesn't, he makes a living in Hollywood. He goes on the Chautauqua lecture circuit through the 30s and 40s. The problem was, and this is one of the most interesting things I think about Thorpe, is that he's so early, and yet the greatest at the same time. He precedes sports agents. He precedes testimonials for tobacco or whatever, where you were paid to, you know, have your name in a magazine, which really flourishes in the 1920s when he's past his prime. He's pre-movie newsreel, so he doesn't have access to these sources of money that the Babe Ruths and Jack Dempseys and Bobby Joneses would have a decade later. He doesn't have someone managing his money for him. And he was, again, and this is sort of haunting to me about his life, and has parallels today, he was trained to be nothing by Pop Warner but an athlete. So there was no fallback. There was nobody there to catch him. And so it was not much of a surprise that he did not manage things well. By the end of his life, yes, he had virtually nothing. It was 1953. He was living in a trailer. He and his third wife preferred to be peripatetic, to move around in a trailer. Nevertheless, I think what Jim really wanted was to, as he said, articulated, was to hunt and fish and sit in front of a fire in Oklahoma, and he never got a chance to do that.
Well, and he died relatively young, Bill, correct?
Yeah, there's actually, how old he was when he died is still controversial, too, but because his date of birth is a little controversial. But he was somewhere about 64 or 65 when he died.
And, Bill, I want to ask you, since you are the expert on the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm, and they were really a standout for many reasons, Jim Thorpe being one of them. There's a funny story I'd like you to share with us before we wrap up talking about Jim Thorpe's legacy, and that's about the Japanese athlete who disappeared somewhere in the midst of his event and wasn't heard from again for a long time. What happened with that?
Well, he didn't finish the course, and he was not very proud of that. He dropped out during the run, and he was embarrassed about it. He got his way back to Tokyo, and then about 50 years later, he appeared again and back stopped. Actually appeared on the course and ran parts of it, although he was much older by then and could not really run a lot.
Wow. So his time was something like 50 years and so many months. And so
something like that.
It was a really, really interesting and memorable Olympiad for so many reasons. And Bill has written about them in numerous books and why that one really kind of stands out on lots of different levels. But before we close, because I'm going to have to say goodbye to both of you in a moment, before we preview the 2012, let me ask what each of you would describe as Jim Thorpe's legacy. And Bill, I'll start with you.
He's the greatest athlete of all time.
Bar none.
Right.
Wow. Kate, what do you say?
I would agree with that, and I would add on to it that the word that I have always used to describe Jim Thorpe, not only as the greatest athlete, but the rest of his life, is perseverance. And it's a quality he is not given enough credit for.
Yeah. Is there anybody that you could compare him to today, any athlete, let's say, today or in recent memory, Bill, that would be comparable to a Jim Thorpe?
In terms of talent, Bo Jackson came pretty close in ability to, you know, be really right at the top in several different sports. Because Thorpe was, you know, the greatest in the decathlon and the pentathlon, and also was the greatest football player in that era. And, you know, a lot of people derided him and said he wasn't very good in baseball. But he wasn't great in baseball, but he was a sort of a useful major league player, you know, not a star. Mm-hmm. And Bo Jackson, again, was a star in both baseball and football until he got injured and probably... And probably could have done the decathlon as well had he done that.
Hmm. Kate, what do you think? Is there someone in today or in recent memory that you think would be comparable to a Jim Thorpe, either athletically or from a sense of his perseverance?
Gosh, well, I think other native Olympians, Billy Mills, would come to mind. And I think it's really important to remember that for native people, and Billy Mills said this himself, he said, growing up in Pine Ridge, the only modern native hero that he could identify with was Jim Thorpe. Everybody else was a mascot or in the 19th century. So for native peoples and athletes in particular, Jim Thorpe looms very large.
Yes, indeed. Kate, tell us what you want readers to take from your book about Jim Thorpe. You've researched him extensively. What is it that you want readers to take away?
One of the main reasons I got into this book was to try to understand, as I said at the beginning of this segment, that Thorpe is the common, but sports are the great common passion of our time around the world. And where does it start and why? And the early history of the modern Olympic movement and the early history of football help tell us who we are as a people, as an American people, because sports were so tightly bound up with our national identity at this time, and it only becomes stronger as the 20th century goes on. And that's one of the most absorbing parts about his story. He personifies that.
Kate Buford is the author of 2010's Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe. Bill Mallon is an Olympic historian. He is in London right now. I want to thank both of you for being with us and helping us explore the history of Jim Thorpe.
You're very welcome. It's been great.
And thanks very much.
And
appreciate
stick around because we'll preview the 2012 games when Radio Times comes right back.
I'm Jesse Thorne. James Brown wasn't just the minister of the new super heavy funk. He was also the hardest working man in show business.
I think why he connected with Nixon is because he sided with that bootstrap mentality of doing for yourself. You can't trust anybody else, and I can succeed on my own.
Another side of James Brown with biographer R.J. Smith on the next Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
When Columbus crossed the Atlantic, it completely altered the biosphere of the Americas by bringing foreign plants and animals, as well as infectious diseases, to the New World. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Charles Mann, author of 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It's just been published in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Penn State students are devastated by the NCAA penalties against them, but author Taylor Branch says they are meaningless. Also, another author says his kids might as well be called Generation Hot. He's calling on parents to do something about climate change. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. We have been talking about the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm, but we're going to fast forward now 100 years to the 2012 Olympics, which get underway in just a matter of hours at this point. Here to give us a preview of the events is NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. He joins us from London. Tom, welcome to Radio Times.
Tracy, happy to be here. How are you doing?
Well, I'm just great, and we're thrilled to have you with us. Give us a sense of what the atmosphere is like and how things are going thus far in London.
I actually don't know how the atmosphere's what it's like right now, because I've been inside all day and I'm going stir crazy, and I'm as soon as we're done, actually, I'm going to be heading to the opening ceremonies, and I can give you a better idea. But the excitement is building. We're a few hours away from the opening ceremonies. People are reportedly starting to stream into Olympic Park. They're expecting tens of thousands of people to pack the stadium tonight, and it's going to be quite a show put on by Slumdog Millionaire director Danny Boyle. And we've had little dribs and drabs, as they say here, of what's going to happen. But we won't know until we see the big show.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about that, Tom, just about what's in the show, because it's supposed to be spectacular from what everybody's saying. So it's going to be very interesting to see, and it sounds like not too much has leaked out about what we can expect.
I'm actually looking forward to this this big showdown, apparently, between Mary Poppins characters and Voldemort. The Mary Poppins characters reportedly, now this is just through sources, are going to vanquish Voldemort and save a bunch of scared kids from him. That would only be appropriate to have her win out. But I don't think she'll, be using violence. We don't want to do that. Maybe using some strategically placed umbrellas. It should be pretty wacky.
Oh, quite.
But opening ceremonies are like that.
Yes, indeed. That's part and parcel. So we're excited for that and looking forward to it. One of the things that it sounds like we will not experience is that moment of silence that has been called for many quarters in observance of the Israeli athletes who were killed in Munich 40 years ago.
Yeah, that was a raging controversy a couple days ago. It seems to have died down. The widow of one of the slain Israelis met with International Olympic Committee President Jacques Roga a couple of days ago and presented him with a petition that had gathered over 107,000 signatures to have a moment of silence. He rejected that, as the IOC has done all along, saying they don't think the opening ceremony is a fitting place to remember that event. He said that we're going to be doing a lot of different things. They have memorialized and commemorated the attack in Munich in different ways, and there will be a ceremony August 6th away from the Olympics, but it'll happen here in London. But what the widow called for people to do was to stand in silence, in a silent protest tonight at the opening ceremony when Roga gets up to speak. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things we'll be looking for tonight. There was a small ceremony apparently at the Israeli embassy in London this morning, and it's been reported that around 200 people held a minute of silence in Trafalgar Square today.
So it sounds like it's being observed one way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's the deal with who's going to light the torch?
We don't know. And that's the biggest secret. You know, it's leaked out in, you know, little bits, as we've talked about. But we really don't know, and we won't know until the end, because there's got to be something that's kept absolutely secret. There's talk that it's could be Daley Thompson, the famous decathlete. Some are saying they were laying laying odds on maybe the great distance runner Roger Bannister, maybe the great rower Stephen Redgrave, who won 5 Olympic medals. But we will have to see.
That is still indeed under wraps, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, as I understand it, it's an American fencer who is going to carry our flag.
That's right. Mariel Zagunas, who has won 2 gold medals. It's kind of neat to, you know, have the sport of fencing, one of those classic Olympic sports that you never hear about other than every 4 years. And she is quite a decorated fencer, and she'll be the flag bearer. And so that'll be exciting.
So, Tom, I'm thinking that you'll be able to write a book yourself by the time you are finished with these Olympics. But share with us some of the, you know, little moments that you've had, some of the, maybe you've got some funny stories to share with us, but some of the things that you have experienced since you arrived in London.
Funny one just happened this morning, as a matter of fact. Walking through the security station, one of the many security checkpoints, all bleary-eyed after, 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And I look back and do a double take, because there's Mike Krzyzewski getting patted down or wanded. And behind him, other coaches from the men's U.S. Basketball team. And then there they come, Kobe, LeBron, the whole group. And everything, you know, is one of those kind of crazy Olympic moments when the famous people show up, although that's more of kind of a Hollywood moment. I kind of think of Olympic moments as like when the rowers and shooters and pentathletes and volleyball players who nobody knows walk by. But these guys went through. And so, of course, I was with my editor at the time. We whip out our cameras. We start snapping. The soldiers there say, no pictures in a security zone, of course, while other soldiers are having their pictures taken with players. And then Philly's own Andre Iguodala was taking a picture of Kobe Bryant being photographed with a guard, and one of the other soldiers said to Iguodala, you know, put away your camera, and Andre looked a little embarrassed as he did. So it was kind of crazy. We followed him in and went to this press conference, and one of the people who we work with, who's been to many Olympics, said he had never seen a larger press conference than for Team USA men's basketball. There were, I think it's easy to say, you know, maybe close to 200 journalists, and it was crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you hang around long enough, you never know who you're going to see over there.
Well, and that's the thing. Like I said, you know, a lot of times you don't know who you see. These athletes who work for so many years to get here, and they're not exactly household names.
Yeah.
Although within their sport they are. That's one of the fun things of the Olympics, is within these esoteric sports, you know, there's a whole culture around it. And if you talk to the people who go to these, you know, team handball or shooting events or archery, they know all the stars and they know all the drama that's gone on behind the scenes.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of, you know, household names, you can't help but talk about Michael Phelps. Tell us some of the people to watch for and some of the events that are going to be key to this Olympics.
Yeah, well, you know, he starts it off with a bang tomorrow with the first of 2 head-to-head matches with his teammate and rival Ryan Lochte, and it's the 400-meter individual medley. I'm being my swimming expert colleague Howard Berkus just helped me with that, and these guys are going head-to-head also in the 200 individual medley, and it's the first medal event of the swimming, so it's a big cymbal crash of a start for that. I'm going to be looking to cover something that may not be on a lot of Americans' radar screens, but I'm always interested in, like, the first medal or gold medal, certainly, for the home country, the host country. And tomorrow the men's road race could have that with Mark Cavendish of Great Britain, very good rider. And that's always fun, and that's another, you know, interesting part of the Olympics, is when the home team starts doing well, because, you know, it's been studied and proved that the home country advantage really does help in bumping up the medal tally for for home country athletes. We saw certainly in the last Olympics in Vancouver, those Olympics really took off the second week after the ice dancers from Canada won a dramatic competition, and after that, Canadian athletes started to win like crazy, and it just transformed the whole games, and it became a really spectacular games. So it's going to be fun to see if the English can come through with a lot of their athletes. There's a heptathlete, Jess Ennis, is one of the people. Rebecca Adlington is a swimmer. You've got a diver who a lot of people are watching. England always does well in rowing, and Great Britain, Team GB has some very good archery teams, both men's and women's. So we'll see how they do, and if they move up the medal. Up in the medals.
Yeah, and what about some of the other athletes, Tom? I'm thinking about Usain Bolt. Certainly the question is, can he keep that title? World's fastest man. Who are some of the other athletes that we'll be looking for?
Yeah, well, you don't have to look far on the Jamaican team. Johan Blake is his teammate and supposed friend, although I don't know how friendly they'll be here at the Games.
His frenemy, right?
That's right, exactly. Who beat Bolt twice at the Jamaican trials. And Bolt has been nursing an injury, and we don't know how he is. But, these supreme athletes love motivation, and he's got plenty of it. You know, he's the two-time defending Olympic champion. He's the world record holder in both the 100 and 200. And now he comes in having been beaten twice by his team. I doubt we'll see much horsing around from Usain Bolt the way we did in Beijing in the 100 meters. And, if he puts his head down and runs through the finish line, we could see some amazing times.
Yeah.
Ashton Eaton, the great decathlete who set a world record, the U.S. decathlete, and Trey Hardy, who's his teammate, they could go 1-2 in the men's decathlon. And then also a very interesting story, Oscar Pistorius in the men's 400, who runs on the prosthetic devices called cheetahs, those curved prosthetic devices that he runs on that have been a source of controversy, but now, as to whether it gives him an advantage or not. But now he will run in the 400 and in a relay, and it's a big moment, and it will be widely watched.
Yeah.
when he lines up on the track.
He'll be amazing. And speaking of amazing, tell us about some of the gymnasts this year.
Well, the U.S. gymnastics team, packed full of teenagers, is if you've picked up your recent Sports Illustrated, they're on the cover, and they're considered a good bet to win the gold medal in the team event. And I believe the last time the U.S. did that was in '96 in Atlanta. So that'll be an exciting thing for Americans to watch. These guys are great athletes. And what they may give up in interviews, because they're so young, they make up for it on the vaults and the bars and the floor exercises.
Yeah,
so that'll be exciting.
Well, I've heard because a couple of them are so strong, they really push each other to a whole other level. So it should be some really interesting gymnastics to watch this time around.
Uh-huh.
Any new events, Tom, this time around?
Let me think. If there are, I am not remembering what they are. It's so vast. That's my excuse.
It is
so vast. You know every day that you're missing something.
Yeah.
And you just try and stay on top of what you can and stay focused. So I'm going to ask my colleague Howard Berkus, are there any new events that were
women's boxing?
You go. That's one of the thank you, Howard.
Equality in the game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, women's boxing. That's one of the ones that I'm going to be covering. I covered the trials, the U.S. trials, that'll be very exciting. One of the fighters in the middleweight division is particularly good. And darn it, I'm forgetting her name now. See, my brain, Tracy, is just on overload.
It's just too much Olympics. And the beauty, of course, is being in the newsroom because your buddies can help you out with some of these things.
Exactly.
So, Tom, yesterday we were all hearing about Mitt Romney making a splash, probably for the wrong reasons over there, making some comments about the readiness, the preparedness, and so forth. Have things kind of died down with that, and what happened?
It has. But he's been perfecting a new Olympic sport. It's kind of called a political backstroke, and that's what he's been doing. And the Brits, who love a good headline, have been calling him Mitt the Twit and stuff like that. And he's just, he made some unfortunate comments, as my colleague Howard pointed out, Howard, who's from Salt Lake City, when he took over the, when Mitt says that Olympics have problems, he bases that on firsthand knowledge. He did a good job with the Salt Lake City Olympics. And so, but, to come over to ostensibly show that you are, kind of a worldly diplomatic kind of guy, and to step in it, if you will, and kind of inadvertently probably insult the host country, not a good step.
Yeah.
So Mitt Romney has been trying to make amends. And I think the best thing right now would just be, to wish Great Britain luck, which he's doing, and zip it.
And one other thing, sort of a downside that we've been hearing about, Tom, is these fake tickets that people are showing up for events you can't get in. They've bought fake tickets and didn't realize it till they got there.
Yeah, and that continues to be a problem. There are some articles today, some reports of some people were having ticket problems, things they had prepaid for and not getting them, and queuing up for hours to get them, or at least told that they're not going to get them. Yeah, so that's one of the the problems that linger here. As with every Olympics, this week before the opening ceremony is filled with stories like that, whether it's ticket snafus or bad weather or transportation glitches, everything comes out. And once the sports start, usually, and especially if the home country starts doing well, all is forgotten.
Yeah,
so
it all works out.
Hopefully, those people will be able to claim their tickets and get into these events.
Hey, speaking of the weather, how is the weather now?
Wow. It was a little cooler today, and I never thought I would come to England and say that I was praying for cool weather, but this week has been tremendously hot. I threw in some shorts before I came over to England, and just on the off chance I may need them, I've worn them every day.
Wow. So what a surprise. Well, Tom, we are so grateful that you had a few minutes to spare to just give us some insight on what to expect in the London Olympics. What's the main event that you're going to be watching for very quickly?
I can't say. What I'm looking forward to is the fascinating things that develop every day, because that's what happens at Olympics. A new story is written every day, and something you would never have imagined happens.
Well, we'll look forward to your coverage. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thanks, Tracy.
And you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.